Good afternoon. It's a Friday afternoon here, and this is a Juno afternoon. I'm Andy Klein, your host for today. Today I'm so excited because the creator of Nimbus is here in the studio with us. Robert Murray is going to be talking about his presentation at the State Museum tonight, and we get the pleasure of talking to him. Rhonda Gardiner is also here to highlight the Not-So-Silent Film Festival at the Gold Town Theater. We're going to be talking to Russian performers who are in town for the weekend concerts. And Beth Loudon is here from Big Brothers Big Sister. It's time to talk about Bowl for Kids' Sake. That's all coming up, plus music, Bird Note, Writer's Almanac, and so much more, right after National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. A southeastern Montana tribe has filed a lawsuit against the Trump administration regarding its decision to lift coal restrictions. Bree Ripley in Yellowstone Valley reports.
The Northern Cheyenne tribe, along with a coalition of conservation groups, sued the Trump administration on Wednesday for lifting a moratorium on coal leases on public lands.
Digging into Mother Earth, taking from Mother Earth for that purpose, doesn't align with our value system, doesn't fit with our worldview.
That's Northern Cheyenne Tribal Council Chairman and President Jace Kilsback. A letter sent by the tribe earlier this month to Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke did not receive a response. Zinke, a former Montana state congressman, said that a war on coal is a war on the Crow tribe, neighbors to the west of the Northern Cheyenne. President Kilsback says they're not going to oppose the Crow tribe in their pursuit to develop coal, the tribe's predominant money-making industry. Instead,
we're asking that if there is development around a reservation, which is a Crow-Dew border, there is some consideration, some respect to look at the impacts it would have on our community, environmentally, economically, socially, and culturally.
The groups who filed suit in federal district court in Great Falls, Montana, include the Center for Biological Diversity, Wild Earth Guardians, and Earth Justice. They are asking for the court to set aside Interior Secretary Zinke's decision and block coal leasing until an environmental review is completed. In a press conference call to reporters on Wednesday, Zinke said that type of environmental review process is too costly and takes too long. The Crow have not yet responded. For National Native News, I'm Bree Ripley.
After decades of waiting and conserving, Alaska Native people of the Yukon-Kuskokwim may soon be able to harvest emperor goose. KYUK's Anna Rose MacArthur reports.
Like any other birds or mammals or fish, they sustain our livelihood and our entity as Alaska Natives.
The last time Roland White of Tuntutuliak tasted emperor goose, he was about 10 years old, when his father brought home game from the tundra. Now White is the chairman of the Association of Village Council President's Waterfowl Conservation Committee.
Most of the communities out in the villages, they are primarily subsistence lifestyle, and all the species that our parents once knew and consumed when they were growing from young age, we are about to start tasting.
Soon, White will be able to bring home the emperor geese like his father did before him, passing the tradition down to the generation that missed it. For 30 years, Alaska residents abstained from hunting emperor geese after the population dropped to dangerously low levels in the 1980s. After decades of allowing the bird population to rise, tribes began asking for a hunt. Together, tribal groups, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and the Alaska Department of Fish and Game created a co-management plan. Now, the subsistence hunt is expected to open April 2nd, with no limit on bag or possession. A restricted winter hunt should follow. In Bethel, I'm Anna Rose MacArthur.
A new Indian center at the University of Wyoming is expected to open this summer. The university announced this week the center is intended to boost Native student success and optimize their college experience. It will honor tribal history and culture and provide study and technology space. It's part of plans by university officials to increase the number of Native students, including members of the Eastern Shoshone and Northern Arapaho tribes. A First Nations leader in Canada is among those recognizing National Aboriginal Languages Day. Assembly of First Nations National Chief Perry Bellegarde says a recent survey shows there's nationwide support for legislation to preserve, protect, and revitalize Indigenous languages, which he says he's committed to working on. There are more than 50 Indigenous languages spoken in Canada. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation.
Support for this program is provided by the Native American Rights Fund, reminding you that sovereignty is not free. Native American Rights Fund has been helping Indian tribes for over 40 years with critical issues such as treaty enforcement, hunting and fishing rights, Indian child welfare, religious freedom, and more. You too can become a modern-day warrior with your support for NARF's work. Learn more at narf.org and join the fight for Native rights.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
It's time for our spring membership campaign, but this time around we're doing something really different. We want to keep the interruptions out of the mix. So basically, we're giving you all the local and NPR programming that you love while briefly reminding you of the importance of the financial support you give. So this message is the entire membership campaign, and the only way that this works is if you make an investment to KTOO right now. It'll take just a couple of minutes, but it will add up to an entire year's worth of great listening for you. So go to KTOO.org and renew or start your membership now.
Over the past few years, to the traditional sounds of an English summer, the drone of lawnmowers, the smack of leather on willow, has been added a new noise.
What were the skies like when you were young?
They went on forever.
Welcome back to Juno Afternoon. Andy Klein, your host today, and some really fantastic guests in the studio with me. Robert Murray and Jonathan Lippincott are here. Robert Murray is the creator of Nimbus, and Jonathan, you are from Lippincott Foundries, and that's where Nimbus was fabricated, put together, and then you kind of create it. So I have so many questions for you.
Fire away.
Welcome to town. Thanks for coming. And first and foremost, we should say that this is part of a lecture that's happening tonight at the museum, right?
Yep, at the Alaska State Museum. So we have an opening, 4:30 to 6, and the lecture will start at 6 o'clock in the lecture hall at the APK.
Okay, so that's great. So it's kind of a wonderful opportunity to talk to the folks who are responsible for creating Nimbus. But I wanted to first, Robert, ask you, when you what bid were you responding to? What request for proposals? How did you read it when you responded to first becoming the person that was going to be the creator of this major new art installment in the capital of Alaska? How did that come about?
Well, it actually, I suppose in a sense, was a kind of a classic situation in that this was called for conceiving and building a piece that didn't previously exist. So my first step was to come up here, fly around in an airplane, take a lot of photos, meet a lot of people. Gordon Smith from the State Art Council was my host, along with the Boochievers, Chief Justice Boochiever and his wife, Connie. And I went back finally with a lot of impressions about Juneau and the nature of the spot and so on, where the sculpture was going to go. And so I worked in a somewhat classical way in that I used a lot of those impressions to come up with the proposal that I made.
And what was the time frame there? Were you selected as the artist that was going to create this piece based on other works? What was it that attracted you to being involved in the project to start with, even before you came up here?
Well, sculptors are basically workers, so they're always glad to get a job.
Sure.
But this was, when I say a classic situation, it was part of the National Endowment to the Arts program for art in public places. And what they did was they partially funded these projects, enabled communities to bring in artists mostly from the outside, and then the State Arts Council and the judicial system were the other co-sponsors of the project. So I met with and worked with all of them. But they, by the time I heard about this, by the time it was offered to me, they had already gone through a selection committee and decided that for whatever reason, I guess based on my past work, that they felt that I was the guy to talk to.
Now, was your past work based in the same type of materials that Nimbus is made in, or did you have that kind of already in mind before you came up and before you started formulating the idea of what Nimbus was going to end up being?
No, it came, well, unlike some of the projects that we built at Don Lippincott's plant, one of the things that was part and parcel of his program was to enable sculptors to build large works without the usual constraints of an architectural commission and so on, which in those days was could be sometimes just that, very mm-hmm. confining, very constraining. But this was a case, when I call it a classic situation, it's where I came as a sculptor to look at a site, and could I come up with an idea? That was the question on everybody's mind.
Yeah.
And it was actually the name Nimbus, I think, was suggested by Chief Justice Boutchever. When I explained to him what, well, of course, he was curious to know what I was going to do.
And what you were kind of describing
right.
to him a little bit
and
about
what
was inspiring you, that kind of
what
thing?
What the concept mm-hmm. I was developing was, he was the one who suggested Nimbus, and it's because the piece has a kind of aura about it, and it being an arch-like form, it kind of surrounds the viewer, and it creates its own kind of space, its mm-hmm. internal space, and that's what suggested to Bob Boutchever that I use the name Nimbus. Well, I liked it, so I agreed.
Yeah.
And
Jonathan Lippincott Foundries is your father's firm, first, and you're there now. So how does your foundry get involved in this fabrication of these large projects?
Well, the company was established to work specifically with artists, which was a change from most fabricators, which were more likely building submarines or bridges or different sort of more classic industrial things, boats. And so my father and his first business partner, Roxanne Everett, saw a real interest among artists in building large-scale works, and they felt like to set up a fabrication space that would essentially act as an extension of the artist's studio, and in a way a group studio, because no one artist would want to hire this many people and this much machinery all the time, but if it was a place where they could come for specific projects to build a piece, that worked really quite well.
So when you're there actually hands-on, welding and working with this material, I almost had the idea that, like, well, okay, so an artist puts together a model, sends it off, and then it gets fabricated, and you check it out and make sure it looks okay. But
well, that does happen, but that's not the way I work.
Okay, yeah, so how do you work?
I like to be involved, and that was what was nice about Don's place, is that some of the fabricators, the commercial fabricators that I'd worked with, they didn't want their customers on the shop floor, and
yeah,
they didn't
right.
want them
bothersome artists walking around. Yeah,
yeah.
Exactly.
So I was kind of spoiled from the very first piece of sculpture that I built, and I went to a fabricator just for the reason Jonathan's mentioned. As I started out life mainly as a painter, and I didn't have any of the equipment to build a good sized piece, so I went to the only metal fabricator in the area where I was living, and said, can I come into your shop? Can you give me a couple of men and to build the work? But, you know, they don't have to make any decisions. I'll make all the decisions. I just want their expertise. And they let me get away with it, first on a trial basis.
Yeah.
And then finally we got involved and committed, and they had no choice but to finish it for me.
So Nimbus, when was Nimbus first unveiled?
Well, it was built in 77. I think it was installed in 78, the next year.
Okay.
It came to Seattle, went to Seattle on a flat car, and then came by state barge up here. And then Don and I met down on the wharf here somewhere and oversaw the unloading with a crane. It came in two pieces.
So let's talk a little bit about the controversy surrounding Nimbus, which is that it has divergent viewpoints. I think you could argue, like all great art, has divergent viewpoints. But it got some visceral reactions from people, both people who loved it and people who didn't so much, and notably by the legislature, and certain members of the legislature really didn't like it. So I just think from an artist's perspective, in some ways you're expecting all kinds of opinions, but in some ways it must not feel that great to have your work criticized that way.
Well, or to have it taken down, which is what happened eventually
right.
with Nimbus. Yeah,
right.
That is not something I've experienced. I always say that I don't intentionally build controversial sculpture, but some of it ends up that way. However, I like it to be provocative. I like it to challenge people and to be something new and different in their midst. I feel that's part of my responsibility.
I mean, I think any art that's not just purely representational is going to elicit that kind of response from people. You know, there's going to be people who just look at it and go, what is that? And there's other people who are going to really experience it and want to experience it.
That's right. Well, so-called public art has that aspect to it that I'd like work that you might build and show in a museum or a gallery where the audience who goes are interested. When you dump something down on a street corner, you get reactions from a lot of people who normally wouldn't cross the street to see it if it was indoors.
That's a great point. I don't know if I even really thought of that before. Even a painting hanging in a museum has already cut off a lot of people who wander by it anyway. Yeah,
programmed to some extent to,
right.
you know,
appreciate
put parameters
it.
Around
yes.
the experience.
Right. Yeah. So, but the thing that's so exciting about Nimbus is that, in a way, because it had this controversial past, it has remained an incredibly vibrant work of art here in Juneau that people still talk about every single day. If you mention the word Nimbus, people have divergent, wild opinions about it, and it's become a really entertaining, fun, and provocative artwork that's lived and lived and lived. I mean, I moved here in 1991 and immediately knew all about Nimbus. You know, and heard about it, and everyone was talking about it, and that's this other end that's so exciting about that work of art. I mean, that must in some way, it's not the way you'd want, maybe it's not the way you would choose to have a work of art be a live work of art in a community, but it certainly is that in this community, and now it's in this new home that's such a perfect setting for it. So let's talk about that. It first went in front of the legislature. Okay, got taken down. Okay, they couldn't handle it or deal with it. But now it's in front of the beautiful new state library and museum in this wonderful plaza that really allows it to have the space and the perspective on it. So what was it like the first time you got to come and check it out in its new environs? Is that in this trip since the...
The museum wasn't finished when I was here before.
You were sort of placing it and giving advice and advising on where it should be. And in fact, as I understood, it actually was a little bit askew when you first saw it, and you were able to correct its...
Well, that was a previous trip. Actually, the first time I came up prior to it being placed was to work with a welder who made up for what had been cut away on the when it was removed from the original site.
Yeah, they didn't treat it with a lot of respect when they first removed it from the site.
Well,
right?
It was done rather haphazardly and rather quickly.
Yeah.
But they followed the grade, and there's quite a downslope on that original site. So as a result, the sculpture wasn't standing straight. Now, sometimes with an abstract work, that's kind of hard to justify, you know, what's up and what's...
Right.
Meant to be horizontal and so on. But it's funny, we're just talking about this in the museum now, is that when you get it right, you know. It sort of tells you itself. But you have to be in tune with the piece itself, and it's very hard to tell somebody else. And then, I couldn't give anybody any decent, meaningful advice until I saw it.
You were hit there
but
in person,
I was
yeah.
shocked, frankly, that we jacked it up with hydraulic jacks 2.5 inches on one corner.
Hmm.
I mean, I didn't think it could possibly be standing and still be that far out of whack.
Right, right.
But it's been a very satisfying experience for me because it's gotten better. Each time it's been moved, you know, when it was moved from the courthouse to here, in front of, beside the old museum, to where it is now, it's, to me, it's very satisfying to see that it still has relevance. As you said, I mean, that's music to my ears.
Yeah, I mean, to me, when you know, because it's been a process watching the library be built, and it was an emotional experience for me to walk around and through and observe Nimbus for the first time that the fences were down and the plaza was done. It's so beautiful. I mean, it's got a fresh coat of paint and all that stuff too, but it's just so Wonderful. And now, you know, there's a Facebook group called Nimbus, you know, Why Love Nimbus or Nimbus Love. And I mean, there's all that stuff developing. We just had a caller call in that asked you if you ever heard a song about Nimbus. There's a song about Nimbus, I think, apparently.
One of my daughters turned up a music group that's called The Nimbus or Nimbus. And they, I think, had one of their record covers or record jackets photographed in front of the sculpture.
Well, there you go.
But I've actually gotten a lot of photos of people who have visited Juno and taken selfies of themselves in front of the sculpture. Including Mr. Wallace.
Brian Wallace had a picture. We have it in the museum high school yearbook, 1979.
So, I mean, it's wonderful that it becomes a kind of a focal point for people and that they relate to it.
And I think even people that maybe didn't quite understand it when it first was unveiled are seeing it today in a new light, and it's well, anyway, it's a pleasure to meet you. As you can tell, I'm moved by your work. It's wonderful to have here. And Robert Murray is one more time on what's happening tonight, a chance to go and listen to the artist and to Jonathan Lippincott as well of Lippincott Foundries. Talk about it.
His exhibit, which includes 8 working models, including the working model for Nimbus, is up at the museum. We'll have that open from 4:30 to 6 and then move across the hall to the lecture hall. Free lecture, 6 o'clock. And I just want to mention this exhibit was sponsored in part by Alaska Airlines and the Friends of the Alaska State Library Archives and Museums. So one more thing. The exhibit is up March 24th through April 15th. So if you can't make it tonight, you have a few more weeks.
And Nimbus will remain up even forever in the spot that it's in. And Robert Murray and Jonathan Lippincott, thanks so much for coming by and talking to us about Nimbus. And thanks for your work.
Thanks very much.
The most beautiful skies, as a matter of fact. The sunsets were purple and red and yellow and fire. And the clouds would catch the colors everywhere. That's unique, because I used to look at them all the time. You don't see that.
Welcome back to Juno Afternoon. I'm done gushing about Nimbus, and I'm here with Amy and Rhonda are here. Not so silent film, silly shorts, all happening at Goldtown. Really fun stuff, and it's a fundraiser all for the Juno Co-op Preschool. So, Amy and Rhonda, tell me a little bit more about it.
April Fools.
April Fools, yeah. I've always been a fan of Colette's Not So Silent Films, and I am a little bit of a wannabe musician who plunk around with my friends on my ukulele and various other noisemakers. But an hour and a half film is a little intimidating.
Yeah.
So, and it's quite a commitment. So I had the idea for preschool to have a fundraiser where we did shorts, and that way all those people who wanted to maybe try it could just go for like a 3 to 5 minute
fun, yeah,
film that
right.
you could do, and actually,
it takes away the intimidation level a little bit.
Well,
you
now there's
fun.
Like 6 to 7 different bands.
Yeah, we're like raising them up.
Cool.
So
yeah.
you know, so Colette will have future musicians who are like, I can do that,
right?
So, but I think we have 10 films and 10
shorts.
And
they're all these like really classic
Yep.
Fun. There's some Laurel and Hardy stuff in there, right?
Yep. And there's some Fleischer Studios is a guy who actually, there's a couple in here that mix animation and live action.
Cool.
So the Alice ones, Alice on the Farm and Alice in the Jungle, and Alice is actually a person doing live action, but then it's superimposed on animation. So that's kind of fun. And then there's some old Felix movies.
Yeah, Felix the Cat?
Yes.
Felix the Cat. Wonderful cat.
Yep, and there's a Tom and Jerry, which is not the cat and mouse Tom and Jerry. And
older
there's
than
a
that.
German one, which I love. And we have everything from...
Does that Primbach the Hobgoblin?
It's in German. Yes, that can be Deutsch. But, you know, the kids can't read it anyway. So
no,
what the heck?
Who cares?
And you just follow
that.
No,
this isn't
it's
just
silent.
For kids, though.
It isn't. This
and
is,
you guys are
you
Pluckster Keaton.
We're Pluckster
right.
Keaton.
You're half of Pluckster Keaton.
Yeah.
Okay, very
yeah.
good.
Yeah.
Well, now... Is there a way that we could? It seems like maybe you even have some ways that you're demonstrating how these might work.
Okay, so you're a band and you want to play along with a silent film. What do you do? Well, first you need a song, right?
Yeah.
So you come up with a song, and we were like, oh well, we just were kind of a little. Not too creative, but logical about this.
No,
we're like, our film was made in 1927.
Yeah.
So we started looking for films, songs from 1927.
Sure. Yeah.
And we found a couple.
We found some that we really liked.
Yeah.
And so then you learn the song.
And are they typically piano-driven, sort of?
No. Well, not us. We don't do
okay.
a piano in there.
But the ones that go along with the films, I always...
Frequently.
Depends.
Yeah.
A lot of depends.
But, you know, a lot of these are 20s, you know, teens and 20s. And so there's some, you know, ragtime stuff. And that has, yeah.
Wow,
we have everything from we have fiddles, ukuleles, banjo ukes, percussion, accordion, marimba,
low piano,
melodica, and then there's a term called Foley.
Oh yeah, so you get the song right.
Okay.
You play the song
yep.
a million times, and then you watch the movie a million times, and then you're like, well, where can we make noises to like, you know,
something or you know something's
right.
walking along.
There you go, right.
Or, you know, somebody gets an idea.
You know, we get
right?
We get all Prairie Home Companion on it, you know?
That was just me actually getting an idea. That just happens.
You should come join us, Andy.
Yeah.
That'd be fun.
Actually, it rains on your head
yes,
when you have a bad day.
Cloud follows me. So, that's super fun, especially the things that, like, for instance, the Battle of the Century, the Laurel and Hardy, that's super slapstick and stuff like
that.
So you're going to want the boing and all that kind of stuff, right?
Give away all
that movie has the most pies in a movie of
any
movie ever. It's like over 200 pies get thrown. In that movie.
I'm already laughing.
There's going to be a bake sale.
There's going to be a bake sale.
It's comedy gold.
And actually, we're showing that movie last so that if anybody gets inspired, it...
You get the pie. There's going to be cream pies.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, hopefully not a real pie fight at the Nickelodeon.
So, okay, let's go. So it's happening tomorrow, April 1st.
Tomorrow, April 1st at the Gold Town Nickelodeon. We have two shows. So first show is at 11 a.m. and the second show is at 4:30 p.m. It goes, like all the films together are a little over an hour, but with all the switching out of music, it's probably about an hour and a half.
Yeah,
show.
But nice breaks in between
and
all that stuff.
You can get up and go. I mean, you know, it's kids, so they get up and go when they're ready anyway. And it is a fundraiser for the co-op preschool, and so it's $10 for adults, $5 for kids, $28 for a family of four. And since I'm organizing the event, I'm allowed to say these kind of things. I would hope that if there was somebody who really wanted to come and that price was prohibitive, that they would come anyway and offer what they can.
Sure.
Because we would rather people come and join in than be like,
you
oh,
want a full house.
Want people to be there. I want people to
Absolutely.
See it and have fun. I want that. Yeah, I want there to be an audience. So.
So sounds great. That's, once again, $10 for adults, $5 for kids. And if you bring a family of four, it's $28. But if that's prohibitive, let them know at the door. The tickets are also on sale at goldtownnick.com, but you can just go by tomorrow.
That's
and
the word, but, you know.
They don't know.
If it doesn't work, just show up at the door.
11 a.m., 4:30 p.m., all happening tomorrow. It's 6 movies in one, plus bands, sound
10
effects.
Movies.
10 movies in one, plus sound effects, bands. All kinds of just
bake sales,
bake
popcorn,
sales,
you know,
pie, and the most pies ever thrown in a movie.
And it's a short one.
It's all happening.
Yeah.
It's Silly Shorts and Rhonda Hamey. Thank you so much for coming by and letting us know what's going on.
Cool.
All
Sounds
right,
great.
Thanks.
Coming up next, here's Writer's Almanac with Garrison Keillor.
And here Here is the Writer's Almanac for Friday, the 31st of March, 2017. It was on this day, 1930, the Motion Picture Production Code was put into effect. It was known as the Hays Code, after the Hollywood censor Will Hays. Guidelines for the depiction of sex, violence, crime, and religion in American movies. A list of 36 don'ts and be carefuls. It was made obligatory in 1934, and from then until 1968, films had to pass the production code in order to be released. The Supreme Court had ruled in 1915 that the First Amendment right to free speech did not extend to movies, so the film industry was nervous about government regulation, and they adopted the Hays Code, which said that crime must be punished, criminals should not be presented as sympathetic characters, pre- or extramarital sex must never be portrayed in a positive light, authority figures must be portrayed with respect, the church and the clergy must not be laughable or villainous, and showing drug use and interracial romance were outlawed. The Hays Code was the reason Ingrid Bergman got on the plane in Casablanca instead of Living in Sin with Humphrey Bogart. But in the 50s, a number of movies defied the Hays Code, such as Billy Wilder's Some Like It Hot, and the production code gradually faded away. It's the birthday of the poet and novelist Marge Piercy, born Detroit, 1936. Her grandfather, a union organizer who was murdered while organizing bakery workers. She grew up working class, Jewish, in an era when anti-Semitism was a constant part of life, witnessed the Detroit race riots. She said, "I knew so many kinds of people, from a Wyandotte Native American to kids from the projects, to kids up from Appalachia, to strivers and strainers and gamblers and numbers runners. Detroit formed me." Author of novels, Braided Lives, He, She, and It, and her most recent collection of poems called Made in Detroit. Here's a poem for today by Kendra Tanacha, making risotto for dinner when his ex-wife calls. "While I mince an onion," he talks with her, planning their son's bar mitzvah, sounding so familiar, so nuts and bolts. "Turning up the gas flame, I saute the onion, translucent, butter, sizzles, foams. As they go over the invitation list, names I've never heard. Adding a cup of arborio, I think of white rice thrown high in the air by the fistful. I pour two glasses of Chardonnay, one for the risotto, one for myself. Sip, then gulp, blend. The band, flowers, menu, heady, I stare at the recipe to orient myself, to understand what I am doing. Add broth, cup by cup, until absorbed. Add parmesan, serve immediately. The word immediately catches my eye, but their conversation continues. Then his son gets on the line and hangs up on him as I stir and stir, holding the wooden spoon." Making Risotto for Dinner When His Ex-Wife Calls, a poem by Kendra Tanacha, from her collection A Filament Burns in Blue Degrees, published by Lost Horse Press and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by the Poetry Foundation, publisher of Poetry Magazine, now available on iOS devices. Subscriptions available at poetrymagazine.org. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch. Thank you.
That's some of the music of the Moscow Nights Trio, who are here now in the studio with me. Welcome, gentlemen.
Thank you. Very glad to be here.
We have Vitaly, Yuri, and Boris from the Moscow Nights Trio, and also Hal Spackman is here from the Sitka Historical Society. Hal, thanks so much for coming in as well. And maybe, Hal, I'll start with you. You have these folks in, you know, traveling. It's, I guess, southeast, right? They must be hitting Sitka and Juneau.
Yes,
is that right?
Yeah.
So that's terrific.
It's part of the sesquicentennial commemoration, and we were just going to have the concert in Sitka, but we were working with the Lieutenant Governor's office on this, and they said, "Hey, let's bring it to Juneau too," and we're so excited because it really, the title of it is Music Without Borders. And the whole point is that by, you know, history has different perspectives, obviously, but culture and music can bring us all together. And that's what this is about. So I'm hoping people come because it is a fabulous concert, some wonderful musicians that I think that you'll be sorry if you miss it. And it's 7:30 tonight at the Elizabeth Paradovich Hall.
Okay, terrific. And so you heard a little sample of it there, but you also have some instruments here in front of you. Vitaly, number one, that's an accordion. Is that right? Or what is it? It's not an accordion.
That is a Russian accordion, chromatic system button accordion.
So, yeah, describe that. Does mother of pearl laid buttons on one side instead of the keyboard that typically we would see?
I would say the accordion are pretty old instrument. As the scientists say and the historian, it took place, at least it came 4,000 years ago, all the way from China, like everything else.
It did? It's like they were like kind of called squeeze boxes or like accordions?
That's correct. But the accordion that I have is probably the most universal, most complicated accordion ever designed that can play any music in any key designed for any kind of accordion.
It can play any music? Like, okay, hit bagpipes. Let's hear it.
Maybe something like this. How about like this?
That's good. I love it. It's so much power behind that instrument, isn't it? I mean, it actually must be a bit of a skill to not overpower when you're playing in a trio, to make sure you're not overpowering the other sounds that are out there, right?
Yeah, but it's just a part of working in ensemble. But by going to the music school from around 6 years old, we got trained to play and learn everything classical music. And when we get kind of established with the classical music, we switch and we play folk music. And accordion is one of those instruments.
So did you first learn other instruments in classical music first? Or
no, pretty much this one is from beginning. Yeah. We start from around 6-7 years old and we go through the music school, music college, music conservatory, and aspirantur. And in Russia they're saying if you're claiming that you can play more than one instrument, you probably cannot play any.
I don't claim any of that, so that's fine. And then, Yuri, you have a balalaika.
Exactly, balalaika.
Okay. Balalaika. And we have a trivia question out there. So if you call in at 586-1212 and you can name how many strings are on a balalaika, you will win two tickets to the concert happening tonight. So we can't say how many strings are on it, but it's a mandolin-sized sort of instrument, right? But with the, is it always have the triangular shape to the body, basically?
Exactly, triangle.
Yeah.
Actually, it came to us from around 14th, 15th century. It's always been triangle. It always had the same amount of strings. And just around 100 years ago, the classically trained musicians with their leader, Vasily Andreev, fell in love with the instrument. They took it to the school, to the shop. He was a professional violin player. They redesigned it, modernized it, and by the sample of the string instruments and symphony orchestra, they created the balalaikas. Little one, the next, there's six different sizes, and as many as 200 play in the orchestra.
So is there like, if you were to play a little tune right now, is there one that like is the universal song that everyone, so that would be, what would it be called? Okay. Okay. There's people dancing out in the other studio. Right? There they go. Oh, very good. Well, that's beautiful. Yes. All right. So is that, and so that's lovely. Now, are there ones that go back centuries and centuries and are incredibly old? Is that?
No, this is pretty much, it came from 14th, 15th century, but modern balalaika that we have very well tuned and designed to play different kind of music. There's no music that that cannot and was not played, that written for violin that cannot and was not played on balalaika. And so some of that we will show at the program. We have a great, exciting program for all ages. We're inviting everybody in June to come and to the concert. We're planning to have fun. We'll get some participation from the audience. And we're so honored to be a part of this great celebration in Alaska.
And then, Boris, what instrument do you play?
Balalaika bass.
So this is kind of a different size?
Big instrument, free string.
Yeah, okay, big human size.
Oh, okay, so like, yeah, just this is a bass of any instrument that you, yeah, so really the, large.
Yeah,
cool.
It couldn't fit to the door.
Oh,
so
wow. And so you're able to get the percussive backbeat sort of elements in the trio by using that bass. And then I'm sure the accordion also provides some bass notes and some beat.
Yes, accordion has two sides. So, and accordion actually has the bass and chords on the left side. So, accordion is a very good instrument that was pretty popular in the United States, right, in the
yeah.
late 50s.
Sure.
And it's give the playing accordion give the great knowledge of the multitasking thing. Because all accordion players, just imagine, with the right hand, with the buttons, 120 buttons, we play melody, variation, improvisations without even looking at that. With the left hand, without looking, we play bass line, chords, major and minors. Same time, we're pulling and pushing. And when we sing, when we're playing, singing completely different melody that's also...
Okay, cool.
And another thing, the fifth thing all accordion players do when they play the music and sing with both hands, they're always thinking how they can survive by being an accordion player in this world.
Yes, so that's, it motivates you at all times. Now, we have indication that we have a winner, so we can now announce how many strings there are on a balalaika, which is three.
Balalaika has three strings, and all of the balalaikas have the two strings tuned same tone.
Oh, that's really interesting.
EEA, in each balalaika tuned differently, and pretty much two notes that you have to start music with on each balalaika.
E and A.
Yeah.
And then, but it doesn't seem like that limits the variations of musicality that you can bring out of the instrument. That's amazing. When I talk to musicians, it's like talking to magicians. You know, it's amazing to me that this beautiful music can come out of these instruments. Of course, it takes a lifetime of
every
practice.
Every kind of music we can play.
We also have a one
little
quiz.
Deep Purple, all right. I love it.
We also have a one Purple, quiz yeah. for you, Jeff, and for the audience.
Okay.
The quiz is, what is the hardest instrument to learn and play, picking from all instruments existing?
I don't know. What is the answer?
Do you want to answer
yeah.
right away?
Yeah.
We shouldn't wait for the calls?
No, let's go ahead.
I guess that is the instrument that you practice at least.
Okay, right. So the more practice, the easier it gets. Well, it's wonderful talking to you guys. Now, there's two kind of groups happening, right?
Well, there's actually three, Jeff.
Okay.
There's the Russian and American singers, and they brought a full choir, 17 people.
Okay.
And they sing traditional Russian folk music, and it's just an absolutely talented, wonderful blend of music that I think, you know, especially if you like choir, they're going to have the costumes, the pageantry, and all of those things that really showcase the Russian culture. As well, Wade Hampton Miller is going to play, and he's he plays in a band called Twangabillies. And so if you like folk music, American folk music, he's really a talented tenor, too. So this concert has a little bit of everything for everybody, because it's about the mixture of cultures that makes Alaska what we are today.
And when you visit here, do you wish that we had never sold?
I wouldn't talk about that, especially right now.
No, that's true. It's good. Oh, you're right. It's all sensitive again. Okay. But wonderful to have you. Thanks so much for visiting. Thanks so much for bringing them up to Juneau as well, and this great opportunity to go to the ANB Hall. And that's happening tonight. Starts at
7:30.
And do you guys mind playing us out into the next segment? We're going to go into a little bird note, just some little tune, and we'll play Bird Note coming up next. Thanks so much to the Moscow Knights Trio.
Pleasure to be here.
third note. In the east, the liquid notes of a cardinal proclaim, "Spring is near." By March, cardinals and other songbirds that don't migrate are already singing heartily to attract mates. And the full richness of spring birdsong is just around the corner. Many other birds will return north from the tropics in April and May, announcing themselves in song as soon as they arrive in nesting areas. That makes now the perfect time to tune up your ear to learn who's making those lovely bird sounds. Cattail marshes will soon ring with the galloping melody of the common yellowthroat. The sweet slurred song of the yellow warbler will rise from the stands of streamside willows, and shady woodlots will once again echo with the flute-like music of the wood thrush. Wherever you live, with the advent of spring, birds renew the world with song.
Today's show is brought to you by White Flower Farm, a family-owned mail-order nursery offering a wide range of perennials, annuals, and shrubs for spring planting. More information is at whiteflowerfarm.com.
Back to Juno Afternoon. Andy Klein with you. And Bill Legere has joined me.
Hi,
Bill.
Eddie.
Thanks so much for coming in. Familiar voice on these airwaves, but this week maybe not so familiar as normal Pledge Drive weeks. You guys are kind of exciting here at K2, trying something a little bit different with this this membership drive.
Yeah, you know, we can't let any grass grow. So we try something new here to try to figure out a way to make the drive more effective, raise the money we need to keep KTO going, but have more of the programming and less of the interrupting. That goes along with the membership drive, and it seems to have worked really well. Andy, we had good results all week, and, you know, we promised that there would be no long pitches, and this is not a pitch.
This is not a pitch.
No, this
just
is an
to be
update,
clear.
An update.
KTOO.org.
Careful, careful.
Wait.
We don't want to break the covenant with our listeners. But other stations have tried this with success around the country, and, you know, it seems to make sense. So we have, you know, intelligent listeners. We don't have to yell at them. We don't have to repeat the phone number over and over again.
But how's it going? Is it,
and
is
it's
it
gone
kind
well.
Of
so
staying on track?
We're exactly right on par with the spring membership drive a year ago in terms of how much we've raised each day, and we're really doing well toward our big goal of $160,000 by the end of June. So what we did, if someone missed it, is we replaced all the live breaks with some thoughtful messages from our local talent here in Juneau and from NPR celebrities and from people in the community with their testimonials. And I heard some just great messages this week that were really inspiring and that, you know, are really thoughtful about giving to public radio.
It's kind of interesting because there's this sort of, you know, in public radio, I've been doing it for a long time, too, and you get that. You get that feeling, well, if people don't hear the phones ring, they won't know to call. And if people don't hear this, if people don't have to hear, you know, minute after minute after minute of pledging, you know, as we call it, then they won't call. But it's fun to hear that people value the service enough just to call by just getting some simple reminders and hearing some voices around the community. And it doesn't have to go on that long.
Yeah. And I don't want to say that we'll never do a traditional membership drive. Again, it's a great way to reach out to new people who haven't been members before, who need a little more convincing. I mean, one of our longtime members said she needs a little more nagging than she got from us this week to contribute.
Well, sick me on her.
And someone else said it didn't seem as much fun without all the hubbub and the snacks and the ringing phones and people coming and going.
I agree with that. I think it sounds fun. You know, I think it's a fun-sounding thing. You can hear the community all there pulling together for a common institution. Yeah,
and we don't want to lose that, and we don't want to become, you know, so automated feeling that there's no life left in it. So we'll find a balance. But it was really well worth trying out, and it does show that there may be other alternatives to raising money. You know, it's really changed over the years. It used to be we raised it all in 1 week in the fall and 1 week in the spring, and you never heard from us again. And now it's really a year-round effort with people making contributions 12 months out of the year and sustaining members and, you know, all of these new ways of giving.
It's also reflective. It's interesting to me to think about how the way people listen to public radio has changed so radically.
Mm-hmm.
And I think those people are still supportive and want to support public broadcasting and like the model, but you're not prompted when you're downloading podcasts and when you're downloading stuff and you're able to create your own content and your own show and your own listening experience during the day. You're not these traditional ways of reaching those people can be changed.
Sure. Yeah. You know, and I noticed this morning that at one point this morning, half of the membership contributions had come from people who don't live in Juneau, who are listening in the lower 48. There was somebody who, Maya Peisel, who made a contribution from Milwaukee and said she's got her radio now tuned to, her NPR One app set to make KTOO her home station.
I know Maya.
And
that's really cool that she's a Juneau kid, grown up in Juneau, and stays in touch with Juneau by connecting to KTOO and this, but via an app, not having to do other. Yeah.
Exactly. So the world's changing. We're changing to try to keep up on it. But Monday morning, I went on the air my first live break because we did a little one. And the first thing I said was call
now.
586. And Matt Miller, who was running
Jim
the board,
do it too.
He looked at me like I had just, thrown everything, all the planning out the window. It was just.
Weren't you at the meeting, Bill?
And I came out an hour later and I did it again. But by Tuesday, I had beat that, you know, I had suppressed that gene.
Yeah.
I turned off that gene to give the phone number and to fall back on the begging. Really.
It's an interesting thing. Yeah, we always, you know, there's this vocabulary that happens kind of behind the scenes in these membership drives, and I'm having to remember to not say pledge drive. I am having to remember to say membership. You know,
philosophies. You know why that is?
Because people
don't make a pledge anymore. They actually pay when they make their contribution.
And that came from pledging, where you just filled out a card
in the
and
old
said,
days,
"I will."
You filled out a card. We sent you a letter in the mail with an envelope, and you wrote a check and put it back in the mail and sent it back to us. You made a pledge to pay later. And now it's not a pledge. It's a contribution.
It's a gift. Yeah, it's a gift that's happening right then. And the nature of how all those things have happened has changed through the years.
Yeah.
Well, good luck with the rest of it. Is it kind of ending
tomorrow? There's no big grand finale, and we're going to be talking about the value of membership from now until forever, but now until June 30th.
So you've got that to look forward to.
Because and on a serious note, you know, I mean, there are some major threats to our funding on both the state and the federal level. And we've got to, you know, we always have been dependent on the community. And you know, we're just going to be turning more and more to the community for that support. And this is another step in that direction.
Bill, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you, Andy.
Bill is your general manager of KTOO, the family of stations here, and that pledge drive continuing, and the membership drive. Sorry, see, I said it. I said pledge drive. I can't say it. People aren't pledging. They're becoming members.
They're giving, yes.
Immediately.
Yeah.
Continuing here.
Thank you, Andy.
Thanks, Bill.
Best things in life are free, but you can give them to the brother and me. I need fun.
right. This is called calling an audible here. We're bringing new people. We're picking people in. Taylor Vidick's here.
Woo!
And Annie B.
Woo!
How you doing, guys? What are you up to? What, you got your guitar, Taylor? What's going on?
My guitar. I just walked in all of a sudden. I was like, oh, now my guitar's in my hand.
You doing a little red carpet?
This is our first ever live red carpet concert. We got Taylor Vidick, who's going to be doing some cool Folk Fest stuff next week. And we're celebrating the closing of our membership drive.
And the start of Folk Fest week.
And the start of Folk Fest.
I'm beside myself with excitement.
Sleep begone. You get all your sleep away right now.
Yep.
Because
I'm going to hide all weekend.
Yeah. I've been altering my sleep pattern, actually.
Taylor, what kind of stuff have you been playing lately? Or what are you...
I've been doing a lot of musicals lately, so that's kind of been taking up a good
that's
bit of
true.
Time. So I've
yeah.
been trying to get back in with my guitar.
Is that West Side Story you were in?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That was
cool.
A ball. Cameron Brockett is getting back to town, and so I've been brushing up on like our older material. So it's been a while for us.
Yeah.
So we'll be playing as the Queen Charles quite a bit next week, and then I put together a group of a cappella ladies, and so we're doing a couple sets thanks to Annie B. We're going to be in the KXL showcase.
Now, have you been
next
writing?
Friday.
I've been trying, but writing's hard.
It is. It's what I hear. I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't write music. What do I know? But
yeah, I just need, you know, you got to sit down, put in, it feels like too contrived to put it in your calendar to sit down and do it. But
Paul Simon says he does that.
Really?
Yeah,
really?
Paul Simon says eight to like one every day. He just goes in to a room. And writes.
Oh, my gosh.
That's how Graceland was
created. That's Paul Simon. Yeah.
I need a Kickstarter, man. Kickstarter means I can sit in a room and write
songs. Most people don't do that.
Go to Gus Davis.
Keith Richards doesn't write that way. So, you know, there's all kind of models out there.
Mama Keith Richards trained myself.
So tell me a little bit about this live. What's happening? How can people listen in?
Yeah, we're going live on the KTOO Facebook page.
Like in minutes, right?
We're minutes away. Happen around 4 o'clock. Taylor's taken over. It's our first live one. We got a new red carpet to celebrate.
It is so soft.
Okay. Well, Taylor Vidick, have a great first kickoff live event here happening now. Thanks so much for coming in and dropping in. We only had a couple of minutes here, but thank you. Thanks so much for coming in.
Of course.
And,
Thank you, Andy.
Anything else happening during the week that people should know about?
KXLL Showcase next Friday, 10 o'clock, Hangar Ballroom. Taylor's going to be playing with the Queen Trails and with the Queens. Also got Goldwing, Liz Snyder confirmed, as well as Jacob Picard and Nicole Church.
Very cool. All right, all coming up. Thanks so much for coming in, you guys. Appreciate it.
There's something there.
That's it for a Juno afternoon for today. Hey, can I make a recommendation for you to listen to Bridge from Nowhere? That's at Sundays at 8 p.m. It's a podcast that I did with buddies of mine, and this week's guests include Marissa Capito from the Juno Solid Waste Treatment Plant and George Kuhar from Playboy Spaceman, together with Lou Logan and Jamie Karnick and myself. It's Bridge from Nowhere, Sundays at 8. Listen in. That's it for a Juno afternoon. Thanks, everyone.
Well.
This is KTOO Juno. We broadcast at 104.3 FM in downtown Juno and Douglas. We also rebroadcast on Translators K276AF in the Mendenhall Valley and Auckland.